We have heard that 500,000 children have died. I mean, that's more children than died in Hiroshima. And you know, is the price worth it? I think this is a very hard choice, but the price, we think the price is worth it.
Hello, everyone. I want to welcome you to the Free Man Beyond the Wall podcast. This is your host, Mance Rader. This is episode 122. It's going to go on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, Evoox, YouTube, on my website, freemanbeyondthewall.com. In the episode section, there's a link to my podcast host, and it'll be on libertarianinstitute.org in the blog and the podcast section. I want to remind you about my books, Freedom Through Memedom and The Kids Are Not All Right. They're available on Amazon. They're also available on my website, freemanbeyondthewall.com/store. And on the website, they are only available for cryptocurrency. I want to give a shout out to another podcast, The Rollo and Slappy Show. If you have not tuned in and listened to Rollo and Slappy talk, you're missing out. I mean, these are good libertarian, anarcho-capitalist, voluntarist discussions that they're having, and I make sure not to miss an episode. So check those guys out. Today, I'm welcoming Daniel McAdams to the show. Daniel is the executive director of the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity. He served as the Foreign Affairs, Civil Liberties, and Defense Policy Advisor to Congressman Paul from 2001 until Dr. Paul's retirement at the end of 2012. From 1993 to 1999, he worked as a journalist based in Budapest, Hungary, and traveled through the former communist bloc as a human rights monitor and election observer. Today, Daniel's going to discuss some foreign policy. We're going to talk about what's going on in Syria, talk a little Afghanistan, and we might just get into a little bit of a Central America, too. So without any further delay, here's a recording of my conversation with Daniel McAdams. All right, I'm here with Daniel McAdams. How are you doing tonight?
Hey, how you doing? Thanks for having me on.
I appreciate it. Thanks for coming on. All right. So everything we've been hearing lately about foreign policy coming out of Washington, coming out of the press is about North Korea. And I know that you appeared, I believe this week on RT talking about people still need to pay attention to Syria. And specifically, the U.S., the government, called on Syria to stop an anti-ISIS offensive. Can you tell us a little bit about what you were commenting on there when you went on RT?
Yeah, I think the setup was great for your question because it is very important what's happening in Korea, and it's fundamental. It's phenomenal. It reminds me of being a rather younger man watching the fall of the Berlin Wall. And it is interesting because it's a huge hotspot. But I think potentially what's happening as we speak in Syria could be even more, at least as fundamental or even more fundamental. And this is that the last couple of pockets of Al-Qaeda and ISIS are in southwest Syria in a very sensitive part of a very sensitive region. You know, this is where Jordan, Israel, Iraq, and Syria all come together. So you can imagine the concerns on all sides, but these are also the last two pockets of essentially Al-Qaeda / FSA, Free Syrian Army, who are now by and large working together, and then one final pocket of ISIS, which really borders the Israel-occupied Golan Heights. So you'd want to talk about high tension. That's high tension. And so the Syrian government, It made it known that its intention is to move against those last big major pockets of foreign sponsored terrorism within its territory. And the U.S. over the past, I would say, 2 weeks has issued several warnings. Don't go in there. Don't go in. This is a so-called deconfliction zone. Don't approach. But something interesting happened within the last, I would say, 24 hours or so, which is that the warnings were less specific in terms of what the U.S. might do to retaliate. And then just on Saturday, apparently, and this is reported by Reuters, the U.S. informed its proxies in the Free Syrian Army that are working with Al-Qaeda in those pockets that you need to make your own choices. but we are not going to come to your aid if the Syrian army attacks. And that is very serious, because the Russians have also indicated, and they have become very involved in this fight. So they've gone all in on this last battle in southwestern Syria, and the U.S. has finally told its proxies, if the Reuters reporting is right, and I've seen several pieces that tend to corroborate that, the U.S. has said, okay, we are not going to go for broke, i.e. potential war with Russia over these last two pockets of al-Qaeda. So pretty interesting stuff.
Now, I don't know how many people realize just what a cluster Syria is.
Yes.
They had the reports coming out last year that CIA-backed rebels were fighting Pentagon-backed rebels. they were clashing. Just earlier this year, we had Turkey, a NATO ally, invading Syrian Kurdistan, where there was, I believe, 5,000 U.S. troops that were on the side of the Syrian Kurds that they would have been fighting. Why is the United States, why Syria?
Well, here's the other funny thing. I think it was just a couple of weeks ago. Maybe it's only been a week ago. Things were happening so quickly. But the U.S. and Turkey reached an agreement on those same Kurds that were fighting as the U.S. proxies. So basically, the Kurds thought they were going to get a great deal fighting on behalf of the U.S., and they ended up getting sold out in the end anyway. So the Kurds are going to be the big losers in a lot of this because they have just made the stupidest choices imaginable. You know, the Turks are not going to be very kind to them, I don't think.
But to go back, one of the questions I asked in there was, why Syria? Why is this – what is so special about Syria that the United States government has invested so much into it?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I always feel like, you know, when there's a U.S. foreign policy action, there's always a confluence of impulses that drive that action. Because a lot of people remember in Iraq, they said no war for oil. And that's part of it. And that was part of it in Iraq. And I think that's part of it in Syria. There is a lot of talk about pipelines, and Russia being, you know, cut off with some pipelines and everything. And I think there's some validity to that, but there's also other issues. There's the U.S. presence in the Middle East. There's the long-standing U.S. animosity toward Iran, and which is really ironic if you think about it, because we've been so ticked off at Iran for so long, but everything the U.S. does in the Middle East benefits Iran. You know, it's like Iran is sitting there saying, dudes, really? I mean, thanks. You know, I mean, we invaded Iraq and threw out, you know, the guy who waged war against Iran for 8 years, killing, you know, tons of Iranians. We kicked him out and a pro-Iranian government came in, and it's still a pro-Iranian government. We went against Syria, and Syria said, hey, Iran, you know, we kind of need your help. Iran says, oh, okay, all right. You know, that sounds okay. So it's really, I mean, I'm not trying to be glib about it, but it's sort of funny. And I think maybe it just shows you for how intelligent the neocons are, how well-educated the neocons are. They're pretty dumb when it comes to their efforts to remake the world. So a long answer to a short question, why Syria is very strategically important. It's close to Iran. Iran is now involved in Syria as an ally. We can't forget that Israel is very, very close to the U.S. foreign policy establishment. The U.S. foreign policy establishment, and certainly the U.S. Congress, feels that it has an obligation to defend Israel above all in the region. With Israel and Saudi Arabia, let's put it that way, Israel and Saudi Arabia. So there's a big factor there. There's a lot of emotional ties to Israel and Saudi Arabia. There's a lot of financial ties. Saudi Arabia spends God knows how many hundreds of thousands of dollars a month on U.S. PR firms. So you have that kind of thing too, and a lot of foreign money buys a lot of Washington foreign policy as well. So all of these things, I think, come together and make Syria the real focus.
Why do you think it is – I talk about Saudi Arabia for a second. why do you think it is that even after 9/11, even after we found out that the majority of the hijackers were from Saudi, why do you think it is that no one would point and say, no one would ask why? Why are all these Saudis, if they're, you know, one of our great allies, sell billions of dollars worth of weapons to, basically waging a proxy war with them in Yemen right now? Why does it seem like we're not even allowed to question that relationship?
Well, I think in a way you answered the question with the question. a few billion dollars worth of weapons. That's what makes Washington. I mean, Washington runs on that. That's the lifeblood of Washington, is the military industrial complex. You know, I was there about a week and a half ago, and on the way to the, maybe I just hadn't noticed it before, but on the way back to Reagan Airport, I noticed a new building on the side of the freeway, a huge building with a huge sign, Boeing, you know, right around Pentagon City. When I was arriving there, I and this is anecdotal, but I drove up through Crystal City. And Crystal City is a very strange place because there are a lot of buildings without a lot of signs on them. Let's put it that way. You have a lot of intelligence organizations having offices there, and a lot of defense contractors. You drive up there, and I have to say, it's one of the nicest, prettiest streets that you can ever imagine. It is wealthy. It's like driving through Beverly Hills. There is a public park for kids with water spouting out all over, a beautiful, well-done thing. There's outdoor dining and very high-end places. These people are extraordinarily wealthy, and their wealth all comes from one thing, having a lot of enemies, of contrived enemies of the United States to scare the bejesus out of people in middle America and convince them to give up at least half of their salary to let these people live in amazing style and luxury. And that really is what it's all about, I think.
Well, coming from somebody who worked on the Hill and, you know, what their concentration was foreign policy, I'll take that as a good educated answer, because yeah, I mean, you've been there, so I'm sure you know. Let me ask you about North Korea for a second, and specifically one question. Now, nobody wants to see this taken care of, this peace on that peninsula. And more than anything, the 25 million hostages that, you know, Kim Jong-un has there, I would love to see them freed, you know, to choose the kind of life they want. How, in your experience, when, you know, with all, you know, working in Washington, how do you negotiate proper, how do you even begin a negotiation, or how do you go through a negotiation with somebody who, how do you deal with somebody who's done that to his people? Do you just accept him one day saying, "Oops, sorry, I really shouldn't have done this, and I want to see change"? How would you even go about that?
Well, I would say there are two things. First of all, it's not ours to accept or reject. You know, there was a great piece out recently by Eric Zoyce, which talks about the whole neocon argument that we lost Syria. We lost Syria, as if it somehow was ever ours to win. It's not our country. North Korea is not our country. There are a lot of people that live in crap surroundings. There are a lot of people that have crappy governments. I think we have a crappy government. We have a government that spies on us 24/7, and takes half of our money and throws us in jail for growing plants. Sometimes for life. So, I don't think it's really up to us to judge how other people live. But I think if you start with the idea that these changes can be organic, they can be organic when you start having a good relation with the country, and they can regress when you start dictating the terms of that new country, of that country's policy. You know, if we send all of our wonderful human rights NGOs in there to demand that they start flying the rainbow flag, it's not going to work. You know, it's not going to work. What will work is, and as much as I hesitate to say this, because I am not, I'm perplexed by this individual, but I think Trump, for all of his very, very strange behavior, has sort of got it right in a way. It's kind of a personal thing. Hey, kid, let's get together. Let's, you know, sit down and talk this over. And I think in a weird way, it kind of works. And maybe this guy Kim is really kind of a kid who inherited a pretty kind of crappy regime, doesn't know what to do about it. You think about a country like that, it's probably not unlike Capitol Hill. There's not a lot of real good information available to them. I mean, I spent 11 or 12 years on Capitol Hill watching these members read only the Washington Post and the New York Times and everyone else in the country saying, oh, these are the experts. No, these are the guys who are in a bubble. So Kim has probably been in a bubble. So I think the best way would be to show him the way out of the bubble and to let him make some of the changes himself and let for it to be a slow transition. Remember, it started with Deng Xiaoping saying to be rich, I forget the quote, but essentially to be rich is to be great. In China, that started a great capitalist revolution in China that ended the collectivism, that ended the Cultural Revolution. And so those sorts of things can happen, but they have to be organic and to go over time and also to retain the kind of cultural aspects of the country that they're taking place in.
Oh, let me, since you mentioned China, let me ask you a question, see if you can answer this. I've heard a lot of people lately talking about how it's impossible to compete with China because they have slave labor. Does China have slave labor?
I don't know their labor policies, you know, specifically. I know that they are operating in a world market where people, there's obviously an advantage to doing business there. But then again, you know, it's not necessarily our business to dictate the internal labor policies of a foreign country. You know, these things will evolve. I mean, if it's okay, let's accept what they say right now, that it's a quote unquote slave labor. That would be still 1,000 times better than it was 30 years ago when there was nothing to do. You know, there was no labor. There were no companies. There was no way to make, you're eating grass, you know. So even if that is the case, you know, it's not our business, you know, we non-interventionists, of course, not our business, to go to a trade war against them because of their labor practices.
Yeah. I think the argument that people are making is that because they can do things so cheap, how can we compete with them? And then they tag tariffs on, and how can you? I think just a lot of people don't realize that we may have come to a point where manufacturing is slowing down. I mean, people say there's no steel industry in this country. Well, that's patently wrong. There is a steel industry. It's just automated. It's extremely automated. I mean, we have a huge steel industry. So,
Specialty steel. I don't mean to interrupt you, but it's also, and we had this problem when I was with Dr. Paul on the Hill, is when we were talking about steel tariffs, we had a company from our district come in and say, hey, we are a high end steel manufacturer, but we depend on China for the raw materials. And we add a lot of value to this and we create a lot of jobs in the 14th District of Texas. And so if we start punishing Chinese steel, we're actually punishing American workers. We can't get it from anywhere but China, some of these things. So, you know, it's always more complex than the demagogues want to make it sound.
And unfortunately, because of the government education we get, we don't learn economics in school. So most people are woefully ignorant of it. And even if they did, they would teach, you know, Keynesian economics for sure. And I think we're in the time, especially in the age of Trump, where a lot of people who don't know anything about most things, anything that he says, they just take it as gospel and they and they run with it. And you know, that's, it's, you know, Dr. Paul never did that when, you know, when he started a movement by just saying some, like we talked about, before, he went up there and said some things and you guys were like, well, this thing's over. Let's go home. And all of a sudden, boom, all this money starts rolling in and people are getting excited about what he has to say. But, you know, he never said, trust me. He said, go look for yourself. I mean, he was talking about ending the Fed. If you wanted to know what the Federal Reserve did, you'd have to go and look at it yourself. You know, you'd have to study it yourself. So he wasn't telling us what to believe. He was, you know, he was telling us, hey, this is what's going on. What should we do about it? And, it started a movement that's still going today. I know I'm a part of it.
It's still going. And, you know, it has been eclipsed to a degree by the Trump phenomenon, you know, but I think it's a temporary shadow. That among some libertarians, they've been taken in. But, you know, the problem is on both sides. You know, the pro-Trump people, they don't want to hear anything. I think, and I share this to a degree, Trump's detractors are so moronic and so stupid. It makes me so angry that it almost puts me in the pro-Trump camp, because why can't we talk about the specific things that he does? And neither side will do that. As you say, one side looks at him as a god, the other side looks at him as a Satan, and the rest of us are saying, can we please talk about policy? You know, it's crazy.
Well, maybe if conversation breaks down and it gets to the point where we can't have conversations, we can start talking about breaking this thing up and making it smaller.
Yeah, that's a good idea. That would be a great start.
Not to sound like a neo-Confederate, but all right. So I sent you an article earlier, and I actually talked about, I touched on this article a little bit on my last podcast, but I really wanted to get someone with your foreign policy knowledge to talk about it, because I think it's, when I saw it, I told you I was laughing, and it's really not a laughing matter, but it's just one of those things that you guys in the Ron Paul camp, you could have called this, that this was going to happen. And it was about the Washington Post article about the Taliban's, has successfully built a parallel state in many parts of Afghanistan. So you looked at the article, what'd you see in there?
I thought it was, first of all, I thought it was amazing that the Washington Post printed it, and it must have been an inadvertent printing. But it really does, you're right, it sort of validates all of the things that the non-interventionists say, because they didn't build a parallel state, they built an actual state. You know, the official Afghani government is a U.S. proxy. We've pumped billions and billions of dollars into the government there, and obviously it's going to be seen by the population as a tool of Washington, as a tool of the government that's been at war with them for 16 years. If you think about, or 17 years, going on 17 years now, if you think about how we would feel if we had been under occupation, if we had been under bombs by a foreign country for 17 years, again, as we talked about with Iran, if anything, our actions in Afghanistan for 17 years are, you know, our attempt to get the government under our control has, if anything, made the Taliban look successful. And to be honest, the first thing I read about this, when I read this, the first thing I thought was they're kind of acting like great free market types. You know, they're seeing there's a great market. There's a great market for what they have to offer. Let's alter our product a little bit. Let's not behead girls for going to school. Let's soften a few things around the edges. And boom, shazam, these guys are looking great by comparison. So it goes to show you, when you're fighting for your own country against a foreign invader, and this is what Robert Pape, you know, 10 years or so ago talked about with suicide bombing. I mean, there's a very powerful feeling, and a lot of us have it, even if we're not, you know, raising, or, you know, flying the flag outside of our front door. But when you're fighting for your own country, your homeland, your community, your people, there's a very different feeling about that.
Yeah, it's when I was reading it, I was, yeah, I, of course, it's not, you know, they're not creating Ancapistan right next, you know, alongside the government, but they are providing services for the people that the people, that the government there has forgotten about. And, you know, think about some of the, not like these Pashtun villages. I mean, I heard stories, Scott Horton in his book, Fool's Errand, talks about, how U.S. soldiers would show up to some Pashtun villages and they thought that they were Russians. I mean, these wow. people, yeah, these people that the propagandists are saying, we have to fight them over there or we'll be fighting them over here. These people will never leave their homeland.
Yeah.
You know, the majority of them don't want us there. They don't want anybody there. Some of those villages speak language. The only language they speak is it. The only people that understand it live in that village.
Yeah.
So, you know, if they're, you know, the Taliban has always, you know, has for at least 20 years now collected taxes from a lot of the poppy farmers. So they've basically set up their own government. They have their own funding coming in, and now they're servicing the people that have been ignored by the U.S. proxy government. And I think it's a I'm gonna use this to talk to people about how black markets creep up, and you know it's an amazing article that I'll link to when I put this up, and I linked to it on the last, but people really have to read it. And you're right, I can't believe the Washington Post published this.
Yeah, I mean the black market is the free market, and that's how people behave. But don't forget other things. I mean, this is not a love song to the Taliban, but they were very brutal against this practice of bachabazi, you know, where the old men would have a young boy as their sex mate, to be honest. And this practice has not only continued, but it's thrived under American occupation. And a lot of American soldiers over there were very frustrated and very furious when they were told, just turn the other way, this is part of their culture. And the Taliban, for all of its faults, I certainly wouldn't want to live under a religious rule. But they put an end to some of these, to a lot of these things. And they were actually pretty nasty against the opium trade before they realized, as you point out, that they can tax it and get some money from it. But, you know, Eric Margolies is, I think, you know, one of the best writers on this topic. And so is Scott, of course. But, you know, we're on the side of the same side that the Soviets were on when they invaded in the 70s, ironically, you know, the side of the communists against the Pashtuns. And it just hasn't worked out well. And I think as in Syria, if we just went home to say a Dr. Paul phrase, they would work it out. The government, the elected government, the U.S. proxy government, they're already in a temporary ceasefire with the Taliban. Not a perfect ceasefire, but a temporary ceasefire. If the U.S. were all of a sudden gone, they would have to have a permanent ceasefire. They would find a way to share power. They would find a way ahead, because it is, after all, their country and not ours. That's what Americans need to understand. It's not our country. And as you point out, they're not going to get on their donkeys and ride over here and invade New York City. You know, they couldn't care less. They could, just like us, just like most Americans couldn't find Afghanistan on a map, most of these people couldn't find America on a map.
Well, and it's even if they didn't find peaceful solutions inside their country and they had to fight each other, what does that have to do with us?
Exactly. People have been fighting each other since the dawn of humanity, you know.
Yeah. And it's so selective. I mean, look at you can't even count on one hand the kind of the fighting that's going on in African nations right now. And you know, I was going to say, and you know, the United States selectively stays out of certain ones, but it seems like they want to get more and more into those now too, arming and training the Ethiopians to go into Somalia and things like that. But I mean, they're very selective about their, you know, because it's always, we got to go in there to stop terrorism. And then, you know, it turned into, well, we got to save him from this brutal dictator, or, you know, so it's just.
But it's even worse than, sorry to interrupt you, but it's even worse than that, because we actually create terrorism as an excuse for us to go in and stop terrorism. I mean, if anything, the U.S. attack on Libya in 2011 created an entire new terrorism industry in Africa that gave the AFRICOM, the U.S. Africa Command, a huge shot in the arms, because all of the weaponry of the Gaddafi government. All of their stores of weapons, they all went into the hands of ISIS types, the Boko Haram, and all of these people spread out throughout Africa. And the U.S. then all of a sudden was rubbing its hands with glee. Oh my goodness, now there are a bunch of terrorists in Africa. We better ramp up our troops there. We better start selling them more weapons and doing all these sorts. So we actually create the crisis that we pretend to come in and try to solve.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you have to want, people have to ask, and if you start asking questions like this, people automatically start saying it's conspiracy theory. Are these manufactured so that people can go in there and sell weapons and send in private security? And, you know, is it just another transfer of wealth to these companies in Washington that you were talking about?
Well, the people don't realize is that, a thug will knife you for $20. What will a company do for $20 billion? You know, I mean, these are ruthless people. They're just like the thug on the corner that's going to knife you for $20. And they can convince themselves that they're doing the Lord's work and that everyone wants to be like us, damn it, whether they know it or not. And if we have to kill them all to prove it, we're going to do it. You know, they do all sorts of things to help them go to sleep at night. But at the end of the day, what this is people who believe that the entire rest of the world has got to be exactly like us, and we'll do whatever we can to make them like us. And, well, we'll get rich in the process, but that's okay too. So it's just a sick foreign policy.
I wanted to, did you happen to notice or see Ralph Nader's tweet today?
I didn't. I have to say I didn't.
Well, actually, it was 2 days ago, but it's just starting to get reported on. And he was responding to Laura Bush and Michelle Obama expressing concerns from the children being, you know, and we could talk about that, the children at the southern border and all this just absolute insanity and proof that government doesn't work. But he tweeted, "Would be nice if Laura Bush and Michelle Obama had expressed similar heartfelt concerns for the tens of thousand children killed or seriously maimed by the wars of their husbands in Iraq, Afghanistan, and elsewhere."
Yeah, I mean, I'm all for whataboutism. You know, everyone puts it down, but I like it because I think it's actually pretty good. Well, what about that? You know, what about these things? What about all these millions killed? Nobody likes to see kids taken away from their parents. You know, I've got kids and that would break my heart. Of course, I would hopefully not do something that would put myself into that situation. But we can't judge how desperate other people are. By the way, these are all people coming from countries where the U.S. drug war has destroyed and destabilized societies, where the U.S. has overthrown the Honduran government. Thank you, Hillary Clinton, and destabilized that country. So we go down and we destabilize all these countries. We fight a drug war. We send in commandos into these countries, and then when people want to leave because we totally screwed the place up, you know, I mean, I'm not in favor of mass illegal immigration, but just like with Europe, when it had to face the fallout for being a good lapdog of Washington and getting involved in the wars in the Middle East, and then all of a sudden there's a million refugees, you got to take responsibility for your actions and the results that they end up doing. So, long answer.
I was reporting on a story about on my last podcast about how one of these contractors that have taken in these children that are split from their parents when they try to come across the border, how in under Obama and under Trump there's allegations and they filed the lawsuit that they're giving them psychotropic drugs. And from the cocktails that I've seen, it looks like they're basically, in lieu of basically tying these kids down on a bed, they're basically doing that, but they're giving them cocktails of drugs to do it. And they filed this, actually turning into a class action lawsuit against this contractor in, I believe it's in Northern Houston.
Houston.
I believe it's Northern Houston and not Dallas, but that's close to you guys, right?
Well, that just goes to show there's something in it for everyone when it comes to interventionism. You know, the big pharma has got to get its take as well. So I'm laughing, but it's not funny. But that's the same thing that we're doing to American soldiers who come back with PTSD. You know, we're not looking at the causes of why they're so messed up. It's just like, here, take this every day and you'll be in la la land. You know, it's very, very depressing.
Let me ask you this. If Dr. Paul was still in Washington and you were advising him on what to say about what's going on the border, what do you think you guys would be saying?
Well, I mean, we'd have a field day in a way. I mean, because I did immigration policy for him, which I hated more than anything. I'll be honest with you. It was the only thing I hated when I had to do it for Dr. Paul, because I'd have a lot of people calling and screaming at me. And, you know, even though it was my job, you still don't like it. But I think it's actually a great teaching moment. We did a show last week on the Ron Paul Liberty Report about it. It's a great teaching moment for our views on libertarianism, on a private property society, on the perils of welfarism, of the welfare state. You know, you can have, and also on the perils of just a blanket anti-immigrant philosophy, you know, because we had a lot of businesses in our old district that the system worked well for a short while, where agricultural workers would get year after year, from Mexico, they would get a guaranteed visa to come here, work on a specific employer, and they would make good money for them. They would take it back home. They would live a decent life. They never would have thought of coming over here illegally. They had a great system. And then you had a lot of these extremists, who said they're taking away our jobs. Like, right, you're going to pick lettuce, you moron. You know, and they destroyed this, and they destroyed the companies in our district, and they destroyed the lives of people down there. And then they wonder, oh gosh, why are they coming over here illegally? Well, you've just destroyed the, so, It's a complex issue, but it's also a great libertarian teaching moment. Even though libertarians, I have to say, are divided to a degree, I think that might be overstated if you look at the real principles behind it, which is, as Rothbard always says, everything comes back to private property.
Yeah, I was reading, I don't know if this is exaggerated or not, but a avocado farmer in California said that he's willing to pay people right now $2,000 a week to come pick avocados, and he doesn't have anybody.
It's hard work, I bet, but dang, that sounds good. I wonder where he's at.
No shit. Yeah, I mean, it's really not that hard. My uncle used to have an avocado tree in his backyard, and they would do a lot of falling. So it was
guacamole. I love it.
Oh yeah, that's one of the things I miss about Florida. But I mean, you're right. It's, you know, it's like what Walter Block's been talking about for decades now. You want to solve an immigration problem? Make everything private property. Make the borders private property. We won't have to have these asinine discussions about public property and if the taxpayers are somehow entitled to public property or, yeah, because their labor is being stolen from them and used for all these things, you know, private, making these things private. And basically here's the whole thing. Like we were talking about tariffs earlier.
Yeah.
Trade should be between two people.
Yeah.
I have this to trade. I have these green pieces of paper that I want to trade for your steel. Okay. So let's get this done.
Yeah.
But the government has to get involved. And one thing over anything else about trade in the era of Trump is the word fair. When I see that, I mean, you can imagine how that makes my anarcho-capitalist, you know, every hair is like, I'm pretty much done with any questions I had. Was there anything that you had specific you want to talk about?
Well, I would just say that on trade and all this, I mean, even with my limited knowledge, and I'm not an expert in Mises, and in Austrian theory, But when I read some about it, I realized that, gosh, this whole thing is really simple. It's just about, quote, human action. You and I, we've just traded an hour of our time for something. You know, we trade with our kids. You do this and I'll do that. You know, it's just a natural state of human beings, you know. And if people would understand this and really start reading some Austrian economics, it's just not that complicated. It's just amazing. And freedom is beautiful.
I think people look at human action and they get absolutely scared. It's a book that needs to be read, but then you have someone like Bob Murphy who writes a modern day condensed plain English version of it called Choice, and anyone can read this. My wife said it was the greatest, you know, it was one of the greatest books she's read, because he makes all the chapters short so you feel like you're accomplishing something.
Yeah.
But every chapter is meat, and that's and when I've been talking with people online about this, that's the one thing they do not understand. They do not understand human action. They do not understand that people are going to act in their best interests. And if they feel like it's not in their best interests, they're not going to act. But as long as they feel like they're getting something out of it, even if they feel like they're like it's uneven. I mean, I've done that. I've traded a gun with somebody else that I paid more money for than he paid for the, you know, for the gun that he had. I didn't care. Yeah. I wanted that gun.
Yeah.
You know, so exactly. Here, I mean, that's one of the easiest ways that I can explain human action to people, to praxeology to people, is I wanted that.
Yeah.
And I probably lost $150 to $200 in the trade, but it doesn't matter.
You were happy.
It's between individuals. So I got what I wanted, and I probably traded it for something else 2 weeks later, but neither here nor there.
And I love Bob because he adds humor into it, and that's really important too. Dr. Paul has always said, enjoy what you're doing, have fun doing it, you know, and I think that's important too, to not be angry and to enjoy it. But you asked me if I wanted to say one thing. If you don't mind a shameless plug.
Please.
RonPaulInstitute.org is where we are. The Ron Paul Liberty Report is a daily show that we do on YouTube. And we're having our big yearly conference on August 18th in Washington, D.C. You can find details on our website. This is always a great event. And it's great because it puts people together who have these shared views. And sometimes we can feel so isolated and a little bit depressed maybe when we go about our daily lives. But if you get 200 or 300 of us in a room and people start changing business cards, there's a lot of profit, quote unquote, in every way. So we've got some great speakers lined up as well. And, it's just going to be a good time. So we would just love to have as many people come and join us as possible.
Oh, that kills me. I'm going to be in New York the week after that.
Oh, well, you should stop in.
On the 18th, that's a Saturday. I have to actually work that day.
Oh.
It's like, and I'll be in New York on the 20th, I'll definitely link to, when I do the show notes for this, I'll definitely link to that so that people can check it out. I haven't been to DC in a decade. And,
we're out in Dulles, so you don't have to go into DC proper if you don't want to. We keep it out. Dr. Paul says, keep it at the airport. I don't want to go into the Beltway. So
that's perfect.
Yeah.
Well, it was great talking to you. I want to do this again sometime soon. Especially if something big comes up, hopefully something positive that we can talk about.
Yes.
But that so rarely ever happens. So
well, thanks so much for having me on. It's been great talking to you.
Oh no, man, you guys do great work. The Liberty Report is part of my weekly viewing. I usually get all episodes in one day. But, yeah, I'm definitely there. And, you know, it's like I told you before we started talking, you were working for Dr. Paul in 2007 when the world changed for a lot of people, and it changed for me. And, thank you for supporting him. And thank you for not advising him to shut up. thank you that your counsel wasn't, hey, don't say that. thank you that you let him just speak his mind, because I really believe he changed the future.
He did, definitely. No question.
Thanks a lot, Daniel. Have a great evening.
Thank you. You too.
I want to thank you for tuning into the Free Man Beyond the Wall podcast. I want to thank Daniel for coming on today. I want to remind you about my books, Freedom Through Memedom and The Kids Are Not All Right. Check them out on Amazon. They're available for fiat there. You can get them on my website, freemanbeyondthewall.com/store for cryptocurrency. That's it. I look forward to coming back at you on the weekend with another podcast. So take care. Have a great week. Bye.